evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Susan Elliott. I'm the Deputy Vice-Chancellor Engagement of the University of Melbourne, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the University tonight for what I'm sure is going to be a really engaging and stimulating discussion. First, I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and I pay my respects to Indigenous people present and to their elders both past and present. I'd like to thank you all for braving the weather tonight. I was speaking to a colleague tonight who said she's been in Melbourne for 30 years and can't remember being this cold. It's certainly a stormy night, so making it out for this lecture attests to the quality of what we're going to hear. So tonight's public lecture, Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, Global and Regional Challenges, is hosted tonight by AsiaLink, an non-academic department of the University of Melbourne, and the Australia-India Institute. The AsiaLink's role is to promote a public understanding, a much deeper public understanding of the countries of Asia and of Australia's role in the region. And it works tirelessly in its engagement over the last 20 years in the Asia region. The Australia-India Institute is a much newer institution, being established in 2008 as a centre for a leading centre for the study of India. And I'd like to acknowledge the presence of the Consul General of India to Victoria, Dr. Behera, who's here with us tonight. Thank you for coming. The third partner in tonight is the University of Melbourne, and we've partnered with UN Youth Australia and with the Australia Institute of International Affairs to bring together a body called Australia's Role in the World, which has delivered a series of public lectures on a range of topics related to international relationships and others such as global health and other issues that are pertinent to Australia in the context of its geoeconomic and political situation. It's a real privilege tonight to be here with two great thinkers who are great practitioners in this area. First, I'd like to welcome the Honourable Gareth Evans, AOQC, who will be well known to the audience and his role in the leadership of thought about nuclear disarmament would be well known to many of you. I'd also like to welcome Professor Amitabh Mattoo, who's Director of the Australia-India Institute, who also has played a great role in thinking about nuclear disarmament in his native India. Tonight's discussion will be moderated by Beverly O'Connor, presenter of the ABC's Asia Pacific News Service. She's a journalist and broadcaster, and she's had over 20 years of experience in radio and television. She's also a columnist for the News Limited Herald Sun. She specialises in economics and politics, but over the years has combined her passion for sport at times with her love and professionalism in journalism. She was the first female director of the Melbourne Football Club, where she served for 9 years and rose to the position of vice president, the only woman to ever hold such a position within an AFL club. She's a life governor of the Drug and Alcohol Foundation, having served 6 years on the board. She's an Australia Day ambassador, campaigner for breast cancer awareness, and ambassador for the children's charities Variety and Auschild. Thank you very much for being with us here tonight. Tonight's event contributes to the university's aim of developing our students as active global citizens. And it's wonderful to join with the community in bringing this here tonight. So I'd like to welcome Beverly to come forward with several bottles of water to open tonight's proceedings. Thank you.
Sorry, as I make these last minute adjustments for this very important occasion. It is terrific to see so many of you, as Susan mentioned, braving conditions for this really interesting debate and topic that is fascinating to me in the current role that I have, presenting news on behalf of Australia into the region. And of course, we know how significantly this issue plays into the Asia Pacific region at the moment, and so central to Australia to take a leading role. As Susan mentioned, I have credentials in the football area, so our two combatants tonight, I always knew that Gareth was a Hawthorn supporter, and I've discovered too that Amitabh is a St Kilda supporter, so you get an idea of the level playing field that they're going to be on tonight with Hawthorn well and truly on top of the table, but it's going to be a fascinating discussion and we really look forward to it. How things are going to work tonight is we're going to hear from both our speakers, and then I'll be having a small discussion with them, but really we want you to participate. It's your opportunity to put your question to these great thinkers and people with enormous experience in this area. So let's first get to Gareth Evans. Of course, Gareth is Chancellor of the Australian National University, a professorial fellow at the University of Melbourne, and President Emeritus of the Brussels-based International Crisis Group, which is an independent global conflict prevention and resolution organisation. He was President and CEO there for 9 years and co-chaired two major international commissions, including on our topic tonight, nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament. He, of course, had a very distinguished political career in Australia for many, many years, and it was really in the foreign affairs portfolio that he really cemented his position as a real global player. Before that, he was an academic lawyer in constitutional law and civil liberties law, and a barrister specialising in industrial law, and of course became a Queen's Counsel back in the 80s. Internationally, he is highly regarded for his role developing the UN peace plan for Cambodia, bringing to a conclusion the International Chemical Weapons Convention, and founding the APEC and ASEAN Regional Forum, and of course initiating the Canberra Commission on the Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. Who could be more qualified? Please make him very welcome, Gareth Evans.
Well, thank you, Beverly, Susan, Amitabh, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. Nuclear weapons are simply the most indiscriminately inhumane weapons ever invented, and certainly the only ones capable of destroying life on this planet as we know it. There's only one other global policy issue which is remotely comparable in terms of its impact on planetary survivability, and that, of course, is climate change. But I think we have to and should acknowledge that nuclear bombs can kill us a hell of a lot faster than CO2. Since the end of the Cold War, even with the recent wake-up call we've all had last year from the Fukushima disaster about how much damage can be caused by uncontrolled radiation, policymakers and publics around the world have really been very slow to accept that disarmament, non-proliferation, not just another set of difficult policy issues, but really are ones in a class all of their own and with a gravity and an urgency all of their own. When the Rudd government decided to put Australia into a foot forward leadership role in energising an international debate on this subject area and initiated a big international commission for nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament, which Prime Minister asked me to co-chair with the former Foreign Minister of Japan, Yoriko Kawaguchi, we set about the enterprise of producing this report, which we did in 2009. We set about it in a spirit of very considerable optimism, because after a decade of sleepwalking, a major effort had in fact been made to shock the world out of its complacency, starting with the quite extraordinary series of op-eds in the Wall Street Journal by four of the hardest-nosed realists ever to hold public office: former US Secretaries of State Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Secretary of Defense William Perry, Senator Sam Nunn, arguing that whatever role nuclear weapons may have played in the Cold War for stabilizing international relations, and certainly they are on that side of the argument then, they argued that in the present international environment, the risks of any state retaining nuclear weapons far outweighed any possible security reward. And then with the election of Barack Obama at the end of 2008, we at last all had a US president totally committed, both intellectually and emotionally, to the ultimate achievement of a nuclear weapon-free world, the vision which he articulated really quite superbly, as I hope some of you remember, in his April 2009 Prague speech. In the consultations that my commission conducted for more than a year all around the world, certainly in every particularly sensitive region, Northeast Asia, South Asia, and the Middle East, as well as others, and consultations that involved every significant nuclear weapon state as well, we sensed a real hunger for major new movement in the three big interrelated areas which really matter if you're going to get serious in this area. The real hunger for new movement on disarmament, in the first place, by all the nuclear-armed states, for, secondly, strengthening and extending the reach of the non-proliferation regime in all its aspects. And the third dimension, real hunger was discernible for strengthening what one might call the building blocks for both disarmament and non-proliferation, namely bedding down the comprehensive test ban on weapons testing, nuclear weapons testing, negotiating a comprehensive new ban on the production of fissile material, that's to say highly enriched uranium or separated plutonium, for such weapons, and eliminating all the security risks associated with imperfectly controlled or secured nuclear weapons and material. And we reflected that optimism, that hunger that we discerned among publics and even policymakers around the world in our recommendations for action right across the spectrum on these issues. And we came up with a whole bunch of recommendations in our report for the short term, which we described as being to the end of 2012, the medium term to 2025, by which time we argued that we could and should achieve a 90% reduction in the world's nuclear weapons stockpile of 22,000 down to around 2,000 weapons, and the longer term thereafter, when the ultimate target had to be zero nuclear weapons. But now it's 3 years later. It's nearly the end of 2012. It's nearly the end of our first period, our short-term benchmark. And I have to say, it's much harder now to maintain that spirit of optimism. In January this year, you may have noticed the hands of the doomsday clock were moved a minute closer to midnight by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the very respected global organization that for decades has tracked the risks of a nuclear weapons catastrophe, whether caused by accident or design, whether caused by states or by terrorist action, or by fission bomb or by dirty radiological bomb. The message was that progress since 2007, when the clock's hands were last set at just 5 minutes to midnight, had stalled and political leadership had gone missing in all the relevant issues. And I think they're right. It's very hard to contest that judgment. Let's work through them. On disarmament, for a start, the balloon really has well and truly deflated. The new START treaty, Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, signed by the US and Russia in 2010, did reduce the number of deployed strategic weapons, but left both sides' actual stockpiles intact. It left their high alert, hair trigger alert status undisturbed. It left weapons modernization programs in place. It left very serious disagreements still running about missile defense and conventional arms imbalances unresolved, and with talks on further drawdowns going absolutely nowhere. And with no further movement by the US and Russia on that front, who between them hold 95% of the world's 22,000 nuclear weapons, no other nuclear armed state has felt really any pressure at all to reduce their stocks significantly. And some states, notably China, India, and Pakistan, have been, on all available evidence, actually increasing their nuclear arsenals. On non-proliferation, The 2010 Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, the NPT Review Conference, was a modest success, mainly because it didn't collapse in disarray as had the previous one 5 years earlier in 2005. But it could not agree on measures to strengthen the regime, and its push for talks on a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East has so far, I'm afraid, gathered no momentum at all. North Korea seems no closer to being put back in its NPT box. For every step forward, and there have been some, there's been steps backward. As with the agreement with the US in February this year for a moratorium on nuclear-related activity and the return of International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA inspectors, being followed by the renunciation of that agreement and, in fact, the conduct of a long-range ballistic missile test in April, and the prospect still being widely speculated about of another nuclear weapons test imminently. And Iran may be closer than ever to jumping out of its box, although this is a hotly contested conclusion. If it did make that decision to do that, as distinct from just acquiring a sort of virtual breakout capability but not actually crossing that big red line, if it did go over the red line, the consequences would unquestionably ricochet very dramatically around the region and, of course, the global economy. On the building block issues, as I've described them, despite Barack Obama's good intentions, the US Senate, I have to say, is absolutely no closer with the raw and crude politics that are being conducted there these days, no closer to ratifying the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty than it ever was, while China, India and Pakistan, among others, take shelter behind that inaction, with a fragile voluntary moratorium being really the only obstacle to resumed testing. Negotiations in Geneva on another crucial building block for both disarmament and non-proliferation, namely a moratorium on the production of new fissile material for use in weapons, again, highly enriched uranium or separated plutonium. Those negotiations remain at a total impasse. And the only halfway good news in the building blocks area is that with the Seoul Nuclear Security Summit, which took place in March, progress does continue on the issue of ensuring that weapons-usable materials and weapons themselves that are currently stored in multiple locations in 32 countries don't fall into the hands of rogue states or terrorists. But progress even here is painfully slow, and there's not much reason for optimism that the original target will be met of achieving complete lockup, complete effective security in all these respects by 2014. So, the message that I believe has to go out to the world's policymakers, and Australia, with its very long record of policy innovation and leadership on nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction issues like chemical weapons, really does have an important continuing international role here. And the message is that policymakers simply have to get serious about eliminating the whole range of risks that are associated with nuclear weapons and indeed with civil nuclear energy to the extent that that plays in to the anxiety about weapons. Neither piecemeal change nor sloganeering is going to do the job. Sound bites and tweets are not the route to nuclear salvation. Nuclear disarmament, non-proliferation, counter-terrorism, civil nuclear energy, risk reduction are all issues that are inextricably connected, and they really do call for sustained commitment around a comprehensive agenda and detailed argument in support of that agenda. Well, what are the elements in that agenda? Let me spell them out, and a number of these things I'll be mentioning will interface with the more specifically regional dimensions of this, which Amitabh will be picking up in his contribution in a few minutes. So let me just go through again in those three categories the main elements of the agenda that's necessary, starting again with disarmament. Although disarmament is by far the hardest of all the nuclear objectives to achieve, the reality is that the nuclear threat is going to continue to hang over us until the last nuclear armed state destroys its last weapon. And getting serious about disarmament means that the five original nuclear weapon states, members of the NPT, US, Russia, China, France, the UK, have to get serious, in a way that they frankly never have been serious in the past, about their explicit commitment under Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to go down that path. And it also means, getting serious here also means, that the three big nuclear-armed elephants outside the NPT that have never joined, India, Pakistan, about which Amitabh will be talking, and also Israel, and if you like North Korea as well, if you regard that as already with the status of a non-NPT nuclear-armed state, these have to be prepared to ultimately eliminate their own respective arsenals. And I think in this context, there are three very specific crucial messages that have to get out. The first is that the threat of a nuclear weapons catastrophe does remain alarmingly real, despite the complacency, despite the indifference, despite the perception that we all probably have that this is yesterday's problem. Existing global stockpiles, those 23,000 weapons out there, have a destructive capacity between them of something like 150,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. We have the reality that in handling those existing weapons, there is an omnipresent potential for human error, system error, or misjudgment under stress. There are regularly now new revelations being made, not least about the Cuban Missile Crisis, about just how close the world came to nuclear catastrophe on multiple occasions during the Cold War years, when the so-called fail-safe command and control systems operated by the US and the Soviet Union are likely, in fact, to have been rather more sophisticated than, frankly, those between India and Pakistan in particular today. And again, Amitabh might want to comment on that. The second message is that Cold War nuclear deterrence doctrine is frankly irrelevant in today's world. So long as nuclear weapons remain, we know that states, whether this is a rational motivation or not, are going to want to maintain at least a minimum nuclear deterrent capability. But that can be done in a way that's very different from the Cold War norms. It can be done without weapons on high alert. It can be done with drastically reduced arsenals, in the case of the US and Russia, and at worst, the current levels for the other nuclear-armed states. It can also be done in a way that reduces the military salience, the perceived salience, relevance of nuclear weapons. States like Japan, Republic of Korea, and to a lesser extent, because of our geographical position, Australia, which do rely on extended nuclear deterrence, so-called, from the US, the US nuclear umbrella, can make a major contribution of our own to reducing the role of nuclear weapons in defence thinking, at least by making clear that we don't rely on nuclear weapons, the US nuclear weapons, for anything other than protection from nuclear threat contingencies. We're not relying on nukes to deal with possible conventional weapon contingencies and so on. All of that stuff would be helpful because it's a very different environment now and we could move down that path if we chose to. The third message related to that is that if existing nuclear powers are serious about non-proliferation, as they all say they are, and do sincerely want to prevent others from joining their club, they can't keep justifying the possession of nuclear weapons as a means of protection for themselves or their allies against other weapons of mass destruction, especially biological weapons, chemical weapons, conventional weapons. Indeed, the single most difficult issue inhibiting serious movement towards disarmament, certainly in the case of Pakistan, in the context of India, about which again, no doubt Amitabh will be talking, certainly in the context of Russia and China in their perceived relationship with the US, the biggest problems these days are conventional arms imbalances, the perceived huge superiority of the bigger power in each case, the bigger, more muscly military power. The biggest problem are conventional arms imbalances, including ballistic missile defense capabilities in that context. And ways of addressing these kinds of imbalances and perceived imbalances have to be very close to the top of the policy agenda if we're going to make movement on this front. Equally, these messages have to be matched by a willingness to map a credible path to ultimate zero, showing how it is possible where we get to where we need to go within some kind of reasonable time. In this context, there are quite a few advocates out there, including the Global Zero movement, who favour a very specific early target date for total elimination. Talk in terms of 2025 or 2030 as being the date certain, the target for nuclear weapons elimination. But I think that approach has to wrestle with the reality that setting actual dates, which are seen by real-world policymakers as impossibly ambitious, does tend to stop them listening at all to the rest of the story. And I think you have to be very, very careful about hanging your star on specific dates of this kind. My own commission adopted a rather different approach on this, which generated a bit of angst from some of the civil nuclear lobbies around the world, because what we said basically was that we should focus in the first instance on a realistically achievable target date, namely 2025, not for absolute elimination, but for what we called minimization. As I've already mentioned in passing, achieving by then a 90% reduction in the world's existing stockpile from 23,000 down to around a total of 2,000, and not put thereafter a specific date on getting to zero, because although as wholly desirable as that would be to get there incredibly quickly if we possibly could, the truth of the matter is that there are three really big hurdles that have to be overcome in getting from very low numbers of nuclear weapons to zero nuclear weapons. And those three hurdles are the absolute reality of geopolitical uncertainty in key regions like South Asia, and again, Amitabh will talk about that. There has to be an overcoming of the psychological reluctance of states to give up their weapons. Try talking to France about giving up its nuclear weapons by 2025, or indeed at any time in the foreseeable next few centuries. That is an issue. And we also have the problem to be overcome, and it's a huge problem, of achieving technically verification and enforcement systems with which every state is totally confident and which will stop any subsequent breakout. When it comes to the second big agenda item of non-proliferation, getting serious about that means, in the first instance, strengthening the International Atomic Energy Agency as the relevant watchdog organisation, and also strengthening the very obvious weaknesses in the non-proliferation treaty regime that have long been identified, in particular, achieving universal embrace of the much more stringent safeguard provision that's known as the Additional Protocol. I'll go into this stuff in detail if anyone wants to in question time. And setting some effective penalties for those like North Korea who purport to actually walk away from their treaty commitments. Agreed language on these issues at the 2010 review conference was really very limp or non-existent, and it really is a matter now of starting all over again in the long run-up to the next review conference in 2015. Getting serious about non-proliferation also obviously means addressing the proliferation risks that are potentially associated with whatever expansion of civil nuclear energy does occur in the years ahead. Although it has to be said that post the Fukushima disaster, that's likely to be a much less dramatic expansion than was previously anticipated. Proliferation-resistant technology involving mainly new reactor designs which don't require or produce sensitive material may be part of the answer in the longer run. But the most immediate need is to ensure that no new state getting into the nuclear energy business for the first time actually builds fissile material production plants of its own to create its own highly enriched uranium or separated plutonium, what have been called quite properly bomb starter kits, for the obvious reason if you have that kind of industrial capability, you really are a hell of a long way down the track towards nuclear weapon capability. That means in turn being able to offer these states absolutely rock-solid assurances of supply of the fuel they'll need in the future from external sources. It means the creation of an internationally managed fuel bank, perhaps, in that respect, or at least some other multilateral arrangement that would pose less risk of nuclear proliferation. The IAEA is slowly moving down that path, but certainly not fast enough for anyone, any serious policymaker's comfort. The most immediately pressing, though, of all the non-proliferation needs is, of course, to deal effectively with the specific problems of North Korea and Iran. Just a quick word on each of these. Although the North Korean problem, on the face of it, is more immediately serious, given that Pyongyang has already tested nuclear explosive devices, already possesses half a dozen of them. In a sense, it's a more manageable problem than elsewhere, because neither of the countries that are most threatened and feel most threatened by this development, namely Japan and South Korea, have really shown any signs of wanting themselves to join that arms race. They certainly have the capacity to do so, certainly in the case of Japan, which is probably not many minutes away from the capacity if it chose to exercise it, but they haven't shown a willingness. There's a huge domestic resistance to that. Equally, I think there's no reason to fear, unless one accepts a sort of a madman theory, which is never usually a very good idea in international relations, despite its popularity in the world's tabloids, that North Korea would ever commit national suicide by actually using its devices aggressively. There's also the fact that with the succession issue now apparently decisively resolved, with a mini-skirted wife and all the rest now in tow, it may be that Pyongyang, that Pyongyang will again get serious about restarting the denuclearization negotiation. Certainly none of us should hold our breath for a result, but the old contain and deter, but keep the door open for negotiations formula does really seem to be working in the case of North Korea. In the case of Iran, although in many ways it's even more troubling than DPRK, both because of the obvious existential threat any weapon it might possess would pose to Israel, or might pose to Israel, and because, more particularly, of the very real threat of proliferation breakout posed by some of its neighbours, particularly Saudi Arabia, one might have said Egypt before, maybe still now after the Arab Spring, Turkey perhaps as well. One might have said Syria before, although that's now a little more problematic in the present environment. Because of that, there is more concern, but I really continue to believe, frankly, as does almost everyone in the analysis business, except apparently Benjamin Netanyahu and those around him, and in that category it seems that we now have Mitt Romney, that this is an issue capable of resolution by that same combination of deterrence, containment, and pressure-backed negotiations, keeping the door open for negotiations. And I believe that any preemptive strike by Israel, with or without US backing, certainly before Tehran actually crossed that threshold and did actually possess usable nuclear weapons, would be crazily wrong-headed. Shouldn't be assumed that Iran's nuclear program has ever been designed to give it anything more than a weapons-making capability. That's capability as distinct from the weapons themselves. And while such a capability, such a virtual breakout position, would obviously give real ground for concern and would also be in manifest breach of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and therefore highly unconscionable and subject to appropriately all sorts of international negative measures in response. That kind of position would, in my judgment, and frankly in most policymakers' judgment around the world, not be a defensible basis legally, morally, or rationally for going to war. But others of you may have a different view about that, as we'll no doubt find out in question time. Final category, the building blocks, testing, fissile material, nuclear security. Getting serious about these building blocks really means, in the first instance, as I've said, in the case of testing, ensuring that the holdout ratification countries for the treaty, including especially China and India, don't continue to shelter behind the failure of successive US presidents to persuade the US Senate to ratify the Test Ban Treaty. In relation to introducing a ban on the production of weapons-grade fissile material, that means countries like, again, India and China, not sheltering, as I suspect they are at the moment, quite comfortably behind the intransigence of Pakistan in refusing consensus on any kind of negotiation at the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva on this topic. And on the subject of nuclear security, that's to say putting loose nukes, nuclear weapons, nuclear materials that are insufficiently guarded against theft or diversion, it means putting those once and for all out of the reach of rogue states and non-state terrorist actors. And that means The agenda here is for every state to offer not just rhetorical but actual practical effort into the full cooperative threat reduction programs and individual national commitments that are actually already in place and have been reinforced at the Seoul summit in March. Just some final words on re-energising this agenda as I've described it. How can policymakers and those who seek to influence them, including Australia's political leaders, when they're in the mood to do this, as Kevin Rudd certainly was, as the Hawke Keating administration certainly was, what can we do to regenerate that momentum that seemed so promising just 3 years ago? What can we do to reinflate the balloon and ensure there's not just full of hot air when it is reinflated? Others will have ideas about how to do this both in the short and the long term, including, no doubt, through the education system, where nuclear issues seem to have long more or less been completely neglected in every country of which I'm aware. But let me just mention in wrapping up three particular initiatives which were recommended by my nuclear commission, and on which at least the last two of them, some progress has recently been made. One initiative, about the utility of which the international community is actually rather evenly divided, is to develop and promote a draft nuclear weapons convention, building on a proposal which has actually been around some time already from civil society and with a number of other government supporters. The idea being here that this would be a framework for advocacy action and a detailed and credible foundation for ultimate multilateral disarmament negotiations whenever these could be started. Given the enormous complexity and difficulty of the issues involved in drafting such a treaty, which is very, very different from a landmines or a cluster weapons treaty, which is the sort of model people think about here, the campaign treaty model. But given the complexity, I think there's little prospect of such a draft convention exercise acquiring the sort of momentum that those other campaign treaty exercises did. I think Amitabh might have a different view about this, but my own view is that nonetheless, while it's probably a quixotic enterprise to go out there and beat the drum as a campaign thing at this stage, to get to work with a major research exercise, hopefully supported by countries like Australia, to produce a fully comprehensive and really credible draft convention, I think would be a useful focusing and energising mechanism, and I think that at least ought to be supported. The second initiative would be to regularly publish a detailed report card that pulls absolutely no punches, and that's something that doesn't happen with intergovernmental formal official reports, in assessing which states are meeting their disarmament and non-proliferation of commitments and which are not, and which states are actually taking seriously the kind of benchmark challenges that I've already identified, the sort of agenda that was laid out by that commission. In that context, I've recently been involved in establishing over the last year at the other place, Australian National University, a centre at the Crawford School of Public Policy, a centre for nuclear non-proliferation disarmament, directed by Professor Ramesh Takur, which is now working to do just that. We're working with SIPRI, the Stockholm Institute of Peace Research in Sweden. We're working with the Swiss government in Geneva to produce a big state of play report, which will be published early next year, doing hopefully just what I've said, identifying who's dragging their feet and what the tasks need to be. The third initiative is to gather together in regional networks around the world, experienced and high-profile, current, former figures from politics, diplomacy, the armed services, to inform and energise public opinion, especially the opinion of high-level policymakers, to take seriously the very real threats, whether they believe there are threats or not, very real threats posed by nuclear weapons, and to do everything possible to achieve a world in which they can be contained, diminished, and ultimately eliminated. Such networks do now actually exist with the Europeans, North America, Europe, and now, just over the last year, the Asia-Pacific Leadership Network, which again I'm convening with the Canberra Centre as the Secretariat. Another such centre is planned for start-up soon in Latin America. So that's the kind of agenda, and that's some of the more specifically practical things we could do, and which Australia could do to advance it. No quick fix is going to turn all this around. Getting the kind of messages that I've talked about here today embedded in public and political consciousness is really going to involve very slow boring through very hard boards for a very long time. But the messages do demand attention. We simply have to keep drilling. The stakes are really enormous. And those of us who care about these issues, and I'm sure that includes everyone here this evening, persist simply because we must, in the interests of ourselves, our children, and our children's children. Thank you.
Gareth Evans, thank you so much for that insight, if not a slightly gloomy outlook on what faces many nations around the globe. Let's now hear from Professor Amitabh Mattoo, Director, of course, of the Australia-India Institute. Professor Mattoo is also a Professor of Disarmament Studies at the Centre for International Politics, Organisation and Disarmament at New Delhi's Jawaharlal Nehru University, and has been a member of the National Knowledge Commission, a high-level advisory group to the Prime Minister of India. He was the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Jammu from 2002 to 2008, and he received his doctorate from the University of Oxford and has been a visiting professor at Stanford University, the University of Notre Dame, the University of Illinois, and the Maison des Sciences de l'Homme in Paris. He has published extensively, writes regularly for many newspapers, and is a well-regarded commentator. He's been awarded the Padma Shri, one of India's highest civilian awards, for his contribution to education and public life. And we look very much forward to his thoughts on our topic here tonight. Please make him very welcome, Professor Amitabh Mattoo.
Dr. Behra, the Honourable Consul General of India in Melbourne, Professor Evans, Professor Sue Elliott, Julia Fraser, Beverly O'Connor, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honor to be invited to speak at this forum, which looks at Australia's role in the world. As someone who has lived in this country for a little over a year now, and who has just familiarized himself with Australian contemporary history, I strongly believe that Australia can and should play a much greater role in the international system, and particularly in Asia. I also believe that there's greater space today than perhaps ever before for India and Australia to work unitedly on critical global issues, including the nuclear one, an issue that, as you all know, that has unfortunately divided the two countries in the past. It's a particular privilege to be sharing the dais with Professor Gareth Evans. For much of India that looks beyond the world of cricket, Gareth Evans has been one of the most recognizable faces from Australia, and he's widely admired, not just for being an extraordinary foreign minister, but particularly so for the commendable work he did as the head of the International Crisis Group in Brussels and as a co-chair with Yuriko Kawaguchi of the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament. My own involvement in nuclear issues has been much more modest and almost trivial compared to Gareth's contribution. I was, for a while, as a student in Oxford, an anti-nuclear activist during the final days of the Cold War in the late 1980s, and even wrote my defil on the British campaign for nuclear disarmment. By the stage I completed my thesis, my activism had been diluted considerably by my exposure to the writings and lectures of hard-nosed realists like Sir Michael Howard, and then the then Chichile Professor of the History of War at All Souls College, another great Australian, Bob O'Neill. As Professor of Disarmament Studies at New Delhi's JNU for about 15 years now, my commitment to the disarmament cause, so to speak, was alas limited to the classroom. That is until last year, when Prime Minister Manmohan Singh was almost arm-twisted by the irrepressible Member of Parliament, Manishankar Iyer, into setting up a panel to update Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi's action plan for a nuclear weapon-free and non-violent order. And this plan was first submitted in 1988. I was part of the panel which updated this plan, and we have mostly completed our work, and I will, in conclusion, submit the roadmap from the panel's report to you today. I must confess, however, that my own views on nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament are not absolute. Nor do I have as gloomy a view of nuclear dangers as Gareth, with your apologies, seems to have articulated. My main argument is the following. Nuclear weapons are dangerous weapons, but which have served and continue to serve an end, strategic stability. The nuclear discourse, as we know it, is mostly shaped more by the interests of the powerful than often by an objective reality. Nuclear dangers, however, will undoubtedly increase in the years to come. But to secure a global agreement on the elimination of nuclear weapons, one has to move at least beyond the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But there is no doubt nuclear weapons are the most inhumane weapons ever invented, as Gareth put it. Or as the greatest Indian of modern times, Mohandas Gandhi, said, nuclear weapons are the most diabolic use of science. The indiscriminate, destructible power of these weapons makes them unique and more dangerous than anything ever invented by humankind. Ironically, and just as an aside, scientists have an uncanny ability to distance themselves from their creations, so much so that J. Robert Oppenheimer, who led the Manhattan Project, which produced the world's first nuclear weapons, is believed to have uttered the words from Gandhi's favorite scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, when the first atomic bomb was detonated in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. And the verse describes Arjuna's feelings when Krishna reveals himself as God. If the radiance of 1,000 suns were to burst at once into the sky, that would be like the splendor of the Mighty One. This is Oppenheimer on his creation. Of course, Oppenheimer did a corrective and quoted another and more appropriate verse from the Gita, again, where Krishna unveils his omnipotent power. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. And yet, notwithstanding the moral repugnance of nuclear weapons, as a student of international relations, I would be the first to admit that nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence helped to prevent an all-out war between the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War. After hundreds of years, Europe, and especially Western Europe, experienced half a century of peace and prosperity. And it would be naive to deny nuclear weapons the role they played in ensuring that there was no war on the continent after the Second World War, however agnostic one may be about nuclear deterrence. Nuclear deterrence does seem to work between states, and that delicate balance of terror, as the great Canadian statesman Lester Pearson once described it, does unarguably instill greater caution in the relationship. Much of the revisionist literature that Gareth referred to on the Cuban Missile Crisis and the work, for instance, of my friend Stanford Scott Sagan on other nuclear crises during the Cold War is not hugely persuasive as a critique of deterrence. What it suggests from an organizational theory point of view is that redundancies that are built into complex command and control system to safeguard nuclear weapons can sometimes be counterproductive. This is not a critique of deterrence, but of complex organizational structures. And of course, we now know that Jack Kennedy was no King Arthur, the White House was no Camelot, and Kennedy's best and brightest were no Knights of the Round Table. But even with a dysfunctional White House and a perpetually philandering president, there was, after all, no war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And let's face it, nuclear deterrence is working elsewhere as well, most notably in South Asia. Since 1998 and the nuclearization of South Asia, there has been no real war between nuclear India and nuclear Pakistan. And they had gone to war, remember, in almost every decade previously. And even the limited war in 1999 in Kargil remained limited primarily because of the presence of nuclear weapons on both sides. As a former member of Indian National Security Council's advisory board, I can, without breaking any confidentiality, vouch for the degree of care, caution, and responsibility that comes with acquiring and stockpiling nuclear weapons. Every stakeholder knows the consequence of deterrence failing. It's just not an option. Indeed, Even in Pakistan's fragile and fragmented polity, the most professional part of the only real professional institution in the country is the Strategic Plans Division, led by a retired General Khalid Kidwai, who's been heading the SBT for at least a decade. And this is the division which controls the nuclear weapons. And he reports directly to the Army Chief of Pakistan. And while the United States, for instance, first used permissive action links to prevent the unauthorized use of nuclear weapons only in 1962, for its weapons in Europe, Pakistan already, it is believed, has incorporated a version of these links to further secure its nuclear weapons. From time to time, true nuclear crises in the Indian subcontinent are invented, manufactured, and simulated in American think tanks or at Foggy Bottom and Langley, and then find themselves on the pages of The New Yorker, a great magazine otherwise, but I have yet to see hard evidence of one actually happening in South Asia. This is not to suggest that there are no problems or that one can be blasé about nuclear issues in South Asia. No, not at all. For instance, the speed with which Pakistan's nuclear arsenal is growing, Islamabad's blocking of the FMCT negotiations, and India's own BM ballistic missile defense need serious consideration and negotiation. But to assume that India and Pakistan may be close to a nuclear exchange is being alarmist. Nuclear deterrence is, after all, based on states acting rationally in their own self-interest. No state wants to destroy itself willingly. Not even North Korea wants to commit, as Gareth said, national suicide. And this rationality is not rooted in one culture or religion or geography, but is universal. Unfortunately, but quite commonly, there is a tendency, an ethnocentric bias, which would suggest that some countries are better at handling nuclear weapons than others. For instance, the idea that there are mad mullahs in Iran who would use nuclear weapons in a vengeful frenzy is preposterous. For anyone who has dealt with Tehran's diplomats or has any understanding of Persian culture. That brings me to the three states which George W. Bush described as part of his axis of evil on the basis inter alia for their ostensible lust for nuclear weapons: Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. In March 2003, the United States attacked Saddam Hussein's Iraq ostensibly because it had evidence that it was on the verge of acquiring weapons of mass destruction, especially nuclear weapons. This was days after the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammad al-Bardai, reported to the United Nations Security Council that, and I quote him, after 3 months of intrusive inspections, we have to date found no evidence or plausible indications of the revival of a nuclear weapon program in Iraq. After the fall of Saddam's regime in April 2003, CIA set up the Iraq Survey Group, which took up the hunt for evidence of illicit WMD and nuclear programs. ISG inspectors, led first by UN Weapons Inspector David Kay and later by Charles Dulfer, visited numerous sites across Iraq where they sifted through documents and interviewed scores of Iraqis. In its comprehensive report issued in September 2004, the ISG concluded that there was no evidence to suggest that a coordinated effort to restart in Iraq's nuclear program had existed since the first Gulf War ended in 1991. The whole idea of an Iraqi nuclear program was a myth, a chimera created by those with the Western interest in the war. A similar frenzy is being created around Iran's nuclear program, which admittedly is in a much more advanced stage. And there's a distinct possibility, as you heard Gareth say, of Benjamin Netanyahu authorizing a preemptive attack against Iran's nuclear reactors. In an interview, if you remember, with CNN some years ago, Netanyahu said that there's only one difference between Nazi Germany and the Islamic Republic of Iran, namely that the first entered a worldwide conflict and then sought atomic weapons, while the latter is first seeking atomic weapons, and once it has them, will then start a world war. And yet, as one of the most incisive analysts of Iraq, Manfred Brot Hedgehammer, wrote in the New York Times recently, Iran's erratic nuclear advances over the past decade suggest that there's no consensus about whether and when to develop a nuclear weapons capability. While it is possible that Iran could develop fissile material for a nuclear weapon within weeks or months, such a high-risk move would require a consensus that does not currently exist in Tehran. Instead, Iran is edging closer towards a nuclear weapons option. An attack on Iran, as suggested by Netanyahu, is one of the very few events that could create a consensus in Tehran that it's necessary to develop nuclear weapons sooner rather than later. And as Hedgehammer suggested, a more logical course of action would be to focus efforts on ensuring that Iran will abstain from crossing the nuclear weapons threshold. In fact, this is the most likely outcome if Iran is not attacked. An Iranian nuclear test would entail further isolation from the international community, which Tehran could ill afford. Not striking against Iran would be the better containment policy. In other words, negotiating, maintaining levels of engagement have a better chance of success. And yet, what should also be fundamentally clear is that the real asymmetry in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf is of the lack of a real deterrent against Israeli nuclear weapons. While Kenneth Walls, a very well-known professor of international relations, in a recent article in Foreign Affairs has been predictably proactive with his title, Why Iran Should Get the Bomb, Nuclear Balancing Would Mean Stability, he makes an insightful point. Israel's nuclear monopoly, which has proved remarkably durable for the past four decades, has long fueled instability in the Middle East. In no other region of the world does a lone, unchecked nuclear state exist. It is Israel's nuclear arsenal, not Iran's desire for one, that has contributed most to the current crisis. Power, after all, begs to be balanced. What is surprising about the Israeli case is that it has taken so long for a potential balancer to emerge. And even North Korea, seemingly the most intransigent and probably with the most dysfunctional political regime, is much more amenable to negotiations than is generally assumed. And I genuinely believe, and this is for your consideration, Gareth, that Australia should and can position itself as an ideal location for track one and track two dialogues with Iran and North Korea. But beyond the complexities of the axis of evil are real dangers of a nuclear weapon being used because of misperception, accident, or by, if they're acquired, by a non-state actor. We know that in the past, Al-Qaeda, North Caucasus-based separatists, and Aum Shinrikyo have demonstrated interest in acquiring nuclear weapons. The hardest part of making a nuclear weapon is acquiring highly enriched uranium and plutonium. There are hundreds of locations holding these nuclear weapons or materials, and no binding global standards about how these materials should be secured. In 1977, more than 30 years ago, the US Office of Technology Assessment said, a small group of people, none of whom has ever had access to classified literature, could design and build a crude nuclear explosive device with only modest machine shop facilities that could be contracted for without arousing suspicion at all. And this was said before we had the internet or the World Wide Web. And that's why, and I agree with Gareth completely, we need to take the nuclear security project so seriously. But there is no doubt in my mind that the world will be safer without nuclear weapons, and nuclear weapon states can then devote their, that the world will be safer without nuclear weapons, and nuclear weapon states can then devote their energies combating non-state actors. But to get a global agreement, we need to recognize the NPT cannot be the mainstay of a movement for disarmament. It's time to think of a new nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament architecture, and it would be great if India and Australia were to take the lead in this venture. The NPT was, in a sense, created in a rare moment during the Cold War when the Soviet Union and the United States got together to prevent those outside the nuclear fire from acquiring nuclear weapons. They presented a fait accompli to the 18-nation Committee on Disarmament, the precursor to the Conference on Disarmament, and put into force a treaty that reflected their interests and their view of global stability. The NPT divided the world almost permanently between nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots. And the NPT rested on three pillars, and all three are on the point of collapsing. The first pillar is non-proliferation. Nuclear weapon states party to the treaty committed themselves not to supply nuclear weapon technology to non-nuclear states, and non-nuclear states pledged not to acquire nuclear weapons. This is a farce. China supplied nuclear weapons technology to Pakistan even after signing the NPT. The US, at the very least, benignly allowed Israel to acquire nuclear weapons. North Korea, as we know, a member of the treaty, had a clandestine nuclear program and withdrew from the treaty once it was discovered, and Iran is even today moving towards nuclear weaponization, even while being a member of the treaty. And if, of course, because the NPT refuses to recognize, due to its arbitrary cutoff date, that Israel, India, and Pakistan are nuclear weapon state. The second pillar was civilian nuclear energy. non-nuclear weapon states had an inalienable right to research, develop, produce, and use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. Further, the treaty declared that the peaceful applications of nuclear explosions would be made available to non-nuclear weapon states on a non-discriminatory basis. The treaty has failed even on this count, with non-nuclear weapon states getting virtually no access to the civilian benefits despite the so-called nuclear renaissance. Moreover, because the popular low-cost light nuclear power station uses enriched uranium fuel, states must be able to either enrich uranium or purchase it in the international market. Neither is being allowed. In addition, NPT countries are being virtually coerced to accept additional safeguards. The third and arguably most important pillar of the NPT was nuclear disarmament. Each of the parties to the treaty undertook to pursue negotiations in good faith for cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date and for nuclear disarmament. Despite considerable cuts in Russian and US nuclear arsenals and Obama's desire to move towards a nuclear-free world, the fact is that there seems to be no real commitment on the part of the N5 to truly move towards a global zero. The nuclear posture review, for instance, conducted by the United States, clearly states that nuclear weapons remain an integral part of American security posture for the foreseeable future. What, however, is inflaming many of the NPT members, including those from Latin America and Middle East, is the impunity with which assurances, decisions, and resolutions arrived at review conferences to which Gareth alluded have been disregarded. The NPT initially entered into force for 25 years in 1970. It was reviewed and extended indefinitely in 1995, only after a series of commitments were given, including on negative security assurances, and especially explicit assurances over the Middle East. None of these commitments has been kept. In 2000, a series of 13 steps was agreed upon, but progress on many of these steps has been at best tardy. In 2005, there was an uproar at the review conference, but not a rebellion. And Gareth talked already about the 2010 conference. And as I said, I think the time is ripe for New Delhi and Canberra to take the lead in suggesting a new nuclear architecture that will accommodate the nuclear realities of the world, create a better balance of rights and obligations between nuclear and non-nuclear states, and address the most dangerous possibility of non-state actors getting access to nuclear technology and weapons. This framework should, of course, be founded on a larger, credible plan for nuclear disarmament. And let me, therefore, finally present to you the 7-stage roadmap that our panel, headed by Manishankar Iyer, presented to the Prime Minister of India. We suggested that first, as a non-NPT state with nuclear weapons, India should reiterate that it is committed to the goal of complete disarmament and to eliminating its own arsenal as part of a universal, non-discriminatory and verifiable global process. And other nuclear weapon states should also be encouraged to make a similar undertaking. Second, India could work to reduce the salience of nuclear weapons in the security doctrines of the nuclear weapon states. India already has introduced the idea of a dialogue on nuclear doctrines among all states possessing nuclear weapons with the United States, France, and Britain. Beginning at the tracto and moving towards the official level, India should ensure that such a dialogue is held involving the 5 nuclear weapon states, as well as states with nuclear weapons, which are states which have nuclear weapons but are not party to the NPT, on security doctrines with a view to identifying ways in which the salience of nuclear weapons could be reduced. The third would be that such a framework could also consider identifying ways of reducing the danger of accidental use of weapons through de-alerting, etc. The fourth element, or the fourth stage, would involve the negotiation of a global agreement on no first use. This would necessarily have to involve nuclear weapon states and states with nuclear weapons, only 2 of whom, India and China, currently have a no first use policy, but countries that live under the protection of the American nuclear umbrella, including Japan, Australia, and South Korea, would need to be a part of the process of discussion, if not negotiation. The fifth element would be essentially binding negative security assurances in which the nuclear weapon states undertake never to launch a nuclear attack on states which have renounced nuclear weapons. And this, of course, has wide support within the non-aligned movement, as well as the New Agenda Coalition of Brazil, Egypt, Ireland, Mexico, New Zealand, South Africa, and Sweden. Sixthly, once the nuclear weapon states have agreed to a no first use and negative security assurances, a treaty moving to a convention banning the use or threat of use of nuclear weapons, and finally, eventually, a nuclear weapons convention banning the production, stockpiling, and possession of all nuclear weapons. There are, at the international level, model nuclear weapons conventions which have still not got much traction, like the one submitted by Costa Rica and Malaysia, which could be revived in some form or a new convention renegotiated. Ladies and gentlemen, coincidentally, we are meeting 67 years after the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki on 9th August 1945, a grim reminder of the horrific consequences of nuclear weapons. New declassified information suggests that the dropping of the bomb on both Hiroshima and Nagasaki had very little military justification, but was greatly influenced by American domestic political reasons and the incipient Cold War with the Soviet Union. Let us all pledge today to never allow that history to be repeated again. Thank you very much.
Amitabh, thank you so much. No doubt, I'm sure you can understand that Gareth has been itching, almost unable to sustain himself throughout Professor Motu's speech. And Gareth Evans, let's start to kick off with the argument that, in fact, the deterrence has been such an effective weapon in its own right. Why not persevere with that?
Well, that's the core of what Amitabh was saying, and that's the core of my response, I think. Let me just say, preface it, however, by saying I'm quite sympathetic to what you're saying about the need to negotiate a new overall architecture, that the mantra we tend to chant that the NPT is the beginning and end of it all, and to make a perfect world, all that has to happen is that the non-signatories of the NPT, India, Pakistan, Israel, join the NPT. That's not a very helpful real-world contribution. We have to approach the issue in a different way, and a lot of the specific subject areas you talked about, I'm wholly sympathetic to. But if we are going to create some new architecture, we've got to start with a bit of common intellectual analytical ground. And Amitabh, if you're going to persist with this latter-day affection for deterrence, nuclear deterrence, we're not going to get very far in these talks between India and Australia, or even between you and me. So we're going to have to rethink what some of these issues are. Let me make four points. There's an awful lot you can say about deterrence, but let me make just four points in response to what you've said. The first one is looking back. Look, preface again by saying I understand perfectly well that deterrence, nuclear weapons, are perceived by all sorts of countries and all sorts of policymakers to have played that role. You're by no means unique in making that judgment about the deterrent utility during the Cold War years. You're no means unique in making a judgment that for where there's a serious imbalance of conventional capability, that nuclear weapons are perceived as an equaliser and having deterrent utility. And that's absolutely true, and that's one of the reasons it's going to take a bloody long time to change the way in which the world thinks about these things, and why we are going to have to address some of these imbalances of conventional capability, and we are going to have to address some of these regional fragility situations before we're going to make real progress. But all of that said by way of preface, the four points I want to make are these. Number one, looking back over the Cold War years, it's really not quite as easy as a lot of people think it is to assert that the reason the major powers did not go to war was because of mutually assured destruction, because of the nuclear weapon. There's an equally strong argument out there now in the literature, in the analysis, which says the nuclear taboo was really always such that neither side was ever likely to be a nuclear aggressor and would have been a hugely reluctant nuclear retaliator, that the real reason we didn't go to war, the real reason, although no doubt, again, nuclear weapons added to the cautionary environment, to use your expression, you know, it added a whole additional factor to the equation, but was because states coming out of the Second World War had just a new appreciation of the absolute horror and futility of massive global war. You might have said they should have learnt that lesson after the First World War. They didn't. It took them another run at it. But in a sense, First World War, Second World War, a kind of an an extension. It was one big war with the gap of 20 years in between. But by the end of the Second World War, I mean, we really, there's a strong argument, we really had, as an international community, learnt a lesson. And this has been extremely well and interestingly documented for those of you who might be interested in a big new book that's been published recently by the Harvard guy, Steven Pinker, called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And it's an analysis of violence in human history. And it's a really careful evaluation of this long peace that we've now had between the major powers and some of the underlying cultural dimensions to it, which are really very interesting. And I don't think we should make the assumption at all that this is just about nukes. Okay, that's the first point. Second point, can you really say that nuclear weapons have operated to deter adventurism from some of the more sort of hot-headed players around the place, leaving aside Russia and the United States, who, would not have done what they did because nuclear weapons were there? I mean, the Kargil case is really very interesting. The Pakistan military adventure in 1999, there's a very strong argument for saying it was because of the existence of nuclear weapons on the Pakistan-India side that Pakistan engaged in that degree of adventurism. So far from being deterred by the prospect of the conflict escalating becoming nuclear, they believed their nuclear defence was so impregnable and the prospect of India retaliating with nuclear weapons to their adventurism in the Kargil area was so minimal because of the reciprocal capacity by then that Pakistan had to come back into the game and knock the Indians over, the Pakistanis felt emboldened to do what they did. So this is an interesting take on the old argument that if you get rid of nuclear weapons, you'll make the world safe for conventional warfare. There is an argument that the possession of nuclear weapons, in fact, through the Cold War years, and in particular as between Pakistan and India, the possession of nuclear weapons, in a sense, made that region safe to conduct conventional war. And that's an argument that I think has to be taken seriously. Third point I'd make is you said, quite rightly, that deterrence theory depends on the presumption of rational calculation of self-interest by either side. Absolutely. That's the core of it. But in the real world of decision-making, in the kind of environment post-Mumbai terrorist incident, when emotions are running as high as you and I can remember they both were in Delhi, and I was in Delhi and Islamabad at the time, when you cut the air with a knife, the prospect of careful, rational calculation of self-interest is something that's very, very, very problematic indeed. And indeed, when you look back over the history of the Cold War, I think it's fair to say, as we say in our report, it's not a result of the inherent stability of the mutually assured destruction deterrent, nuclear deterrence system. It's not certainly the product of any inherent statesmanship on the part of the leadership of the major blocs during the Cold War years. Rather, the fact that we did not have a nuclear weapons catastrophe during the whole Cold War years is a function of sheer dumb luck. Sheer dumb luck, because so often human error, system error, miscalculation, misperception could have taken this thing over the edge. And there are example after example after example out there in the literature now. The one that I like best is the Cuban Missile Crisis, when people just don't realise how close we were to World War III, but it's now come out in the literature. The closest of all was when there were Russian submarines in the Caribbean surrounding Cuba. At the time, and for a long time afterwards, it was believed that there were no actual nuclear weapons on Cuba or in the water, and they were coming by ship, and the whole nature of the blockade enterprise and the tension was to stop weapons arriving in Cuba. But in fact, there were a number of submarines with nuclear-tipped torpedoes, Russian submarines, Soviet submarines in the water. And on one occasion during the crisis, US naval ships were dropping depth charges, not in order to actually destroy the submarines that would have precipitated a real crisis, but just to indicate that the US was there and to give them a bit of hurry up. But one such depth charge actually knocked out the communications of the Soviet submarine. And the protocols that applied in those circumstances from Moscow were that if a submarine lost its communications as a result of some kind of enemy action, it was left completely to the discretion of the submarine commander as to whether to fire his nuclear torpedo. The presumption being, of course, that if you knocked out enemy action, the war's already going on, so use them or lose them, the war is on. In fact, the submarine commander in question thought that was a hell of a big decision to make, so he put it to a vote. of himself and the two deputies on the submarine. And let me tell you, by a vote of 2-1, World War III was averted. So, I mean, this is the reality. I mean, the other point to make in this context is rational calculation, India, Pakistan, absolute geographical neighbours, flight time from Pakistan launch sites with a low trajectory missile into India to target, flight time to target 5 minutes, maybe 8 or 9 minutes if you go ballistic, if you go low trajectory, 5 minutes. How in the hell is it possible if in a high tension situation, as a result of cyber misinformation or as a result of system error or human error, you get screen evidence of nukes coming in? How in the hell is it possible to make a rational calculation as to whether this is a nuclear attack and that's, you know, and whether to respond to it or not? I mean, this is the reality. It's sheer dumb luck that it hasn't happened in the past, and as you get more players in the game, it's ever more luck. And the very final point is the one about more players in the game. How the hell do we advocate the utility of deterrence without acknowledging the utility of deterrence for every state that might have a security problem? I know, Amitabh, you don't like the discriminatory character of the NPT and the non-proliferation regime, but I've never heard you expressing an ounce of sympathy for proliferation in any shape or form. But equally, I hear you defending the deterrent role of nukes for India, no doubt you, Pakistan, for the existing players. But you are stuck. I mean, if you acknowledge the utility of deterrence as a proper foundation for having nukes, it's very hard not to say, well, that's a legitimate security protection that any self-respecting state ought to be able to have. But of course, we don't want to say that, and the reason we don't want to say it was because we do know perfectly well that there are risks associated with the possession of nuclear weapons. And so the whole argument that we can somehow have a risk-free deterrent environment continuing into the future, I think, frankly, is with absolute respect a nonsense.
I can't deny you, right of reply, Amitabh, has it been pure dumb luck?
You know, with the what's been happening and is that I'm not suggesting it's a conspiracy, but there is more and more declassified information which seems to suggest that there were these incidents. Scott Sagan has identified a large number of incidents that happened and that the Soviet Union and the United States came close to war. I'm not the one who's actually looked at, there's a national security archive which looks at all that classified information. It seems a bit strange that all this classified information is coming out at a time when the non-proliferation project, as far as the United States is concerned, is topmost priority. I'm not suggesting that all this is selectively done or deliberately done. All I'm suggesting is that at the end of the day, the fact was that there was no major all-out war between the United States and the Soviet Union, and that nuclear weapons may have played one role in ensuring that war didn't take place. Of course, there are other, as with any good sophisticated social science reading or analysis, you would offer other explanations. Culturally, there was a nuclear taboo, and that people had learned from the horrific experiences of the Second World War. That didn't prevent Stalin from doing what he did in the gulags of the Soviet Union, of massacring millions of people, or entering Hungary in 1956, or the intervention in 1968 in Czechoslovakia. So there is a history of what the Soviet Union did within its own camp, or what both the United States and the Soviet Union did in countries outside Europe, in Africa and in Asia. So in other words, I think while you can give some credence to those explanations based on lessons learned from history, if you look at all the narratives produced by people who were in government at that stage, including Henry Kissinger and others, and Henry Kissinger, despite having written the article along with the other four, has now, with Brent Snowcraft, written a new version of why he thinks nuclear weapons are still important and why America should not give up nuclear weapons beyond a certain number. All of the from Kissinger to McNamara, although they may have critiqued many of the facets of American policy, believed that nuclear deterrence played a key role in deterring the Soviet Union. So the proof of the pudding is really in the eating, in the way that American policymakers behaved. And I'm sure people like Gromyko and others had similar views. I haven't just read them. But I completely agree with Garrett that there are inherent dangers. All I'm suggesting is that nuclear weapons have played a role. Certainly from the Indian side, I can say with greater confidence that the restraint, the caution, even after Mumbai, was related to nuclearization. And yes, Kargil was an adventure, and it was an adventure because this was an incipient deterrent regime being built in South Asia, but Pakistan learned its lesson fairly quickly. Nawaz Sharif went to the United States, had a summit meeting with Bill Clinton, and agreed to withdraw forces from Kargil. So that was an adventure behind Nawaz's back by the army. And deterrence in some ways is also a learning process. It's not static. You learn as you understand your adversary. But I agree with Garrett that there are dangers of misperception, of accident, and of non-state actors acquiring nuclear weapons. And that's why I think it's important to have a credible plan for nuclear disarmament, which goes beyond the NPT. And so there isn't fundamentally, Garrett, to try and be more reconciliatory than you were, there isn't much in terms of ends that divides us, except that Australia has had the luxury of having the extended deterrence of the United States and a luxury within which it can campaign more effectively for nuclear disarmament. India has lived in a more troubled neighborhood. So it probably reflects our of growing up in a more troubled neighborhood, my ideas at least.
Okay. Now, I'm going to have to ask both of you to maybe keep your answers a little shorter so that we can perhaps get a few more questions. But I'd like to maybe get some common ground to both of you. And I'm interested in your views on the role that Russia is playing through Vladimir Putin. And it seems to me that he is positioning himself quite interestingly with that sort of axis of evil rather than perhaps after the rapprochement of the post-communist era. How do you view his actions and how he's positioning himself in relation to this nuclear threat?
Well, there's no doubt that Vladimir Putin sees nuclear weapons possession as a status, as a prestige thing, as the way in which Russia can really claim the status of being a world-class power, which every other indicator would deny it. It's purely the possession of as many weapons, about 13,000 of them as it does, that means Russia has to be taken seriously. And Putin knows that and plays that for every inch and is not going to give up anytime soon, any more than France is going to give up anytime soon, because it's one of the things that's just an important part of French nationalist pride, self-identification. But the problem in terms of taking further the US-Russia arms control negotiations, which on the face of it is in everybody's interest, to at least, even if you're not getting to zero and not abandoning that status completely, at least there's a case surely for coming down to no more than 500 or 1,000 such weapons each. The real problem now with Russia is not one that's entirely something you can sneer at Putin and the Russians about. There are two issues in particular that the Russians say are showstoppers in terms of them getting back into another round of serious negotiations with the US. Number one is the extraordinary imbalance of conventional arms capability, not least the US enthusiasm for new forms of exercising its conventional muscle through, in particular, something that really spooks the Russians and the Chinese for that matter, which is this concept of global strike, PGS. What's the P stand for? Whatever. The idea is putting conventional weapons on ballistic missiles and basically using conventional weapons and the capability that the US has to deliver conventional weapons more precisely and over greater distances than anyone else to do things which previously were thought to be the sole milieu of nuclear weapons.
and just the overall, the sheer proponent, the fact that the US is spending more than the rest of the world put together on defence, is something that the Russians and the Chinese don't take lightly. Combined with that is the issue of ballistic missile defence, which really is going to keep on recurring as a haunting factor, inhibiting any serious move towards global elimination, because the trouble with effective ballistic missile defence is that it is something that reduces the utility of your retaliatory capability, and as such makes you enthusiastic about having even more nuclear weapons, because you're going to lose a large number of them notionally as a result of that defensive capability. So this is the mindset that the Russians have got into, that Americans have greater technical capability than they have in that area. They're not terribly enthusiastic about pursuing the sort of cooperative use of ballistic missile defence against third-party threats from Iran and so on, which looked for a while as a productive way forward. They're saying that this is really just a blind for the US acquiring really a capacity to reduce that even-handedness in our respective armories and acquire a capability to knock us out. And unless the US really seriously addresses those anxieties about BMD and about conventional, we're not going to get very far with the US-Russia arms reductions. And unless there's movement on the US-Russia front, as I said, we're not going to get very far at all with any of the other nuclear armed states, either within the NPT framework or outside it, because they'll say, with those guys having 14,000 or 10 plus thousand each, our few hundred look pretty trivial by comparison. Why the hell should we exercise any discipline? So this is actually really important stuff. So the Russian thing has to be taken seriously in that sense, even though, frankly, one's entitled to be, and this has been reinforced by the behaviour over Syria and so on, totally cynical and totally sceptical about the good faith of the current Russian administration on basic issues of international security, but they do have something to say.
I completely agree with Gareth. A new Russian nationalism bordering, I feel, on jingoism, compounded by what is perceived as an American lack of sensitivity to their concerns, especially on conventional imbalances and particularly ballistic missile defense. So this is part of Putin's project to revive Great Russia. It's not going to be easy to negotiate with him, but I would imagine that Americans would find compromising on key issues like BMD extremely difficult in any case.
It is time now for us to wrap up this conversation. I know that there'd be many more questions, as I can see hands coming up, but we do need to wrap it up. And I'd like to now welcome Julia Fraser, the Associate Director of AsiaLink and a board member of the Australia-India Institute, to just say a vote of thanks.
Sue Elliott, I want you to know I think you've achieved your ambition of having students gain a lot from this. When I remember back as a student in this university, there were maybe one or two memories that I have of great speakers, visiting speakers, who came and inspired me. You people here who are students at this university and at Monash, I think you will remember many years to come what you've got tonight. You are so lucky and we are so fortunate. We're so fortunate to have you, Gareth, who someone that we admired here, but I know is well admired on the world stage. We forget, a lot of people forget about the work that you did in Cambodia, and I can tell you, going back to Cambodia now, people still talk about your initiatives there. Amitav Mattoo, oh, I don't know how we got you and how fortunate we are that we have. But we've learnt so much from you in these 12 months and tonight as well. Thank you for coming too to support your husband. It's lovely to see you in the audience, Ms. Mattoo. Please thank our speakers, but thank Beverly, because God, Beverly, you had a very difficult job tonight. thank you so much. And thank you to the university. Thank you to the partners in Australia's role. The youth element is something that we encourage at AsiaLink. And thank you also to our dear friends and colleagues at the Australia-India Institute. What a wonderful night. Thank you very, very much.